We made this.
Hello and welcome to The Time Is Now. I'm your host, Darren Mooney. Soylent Green is people. And we actually have a very special guest here for this episode. We're going to be talking about Luminary, which is obviously the episode of the second season. But before we do that, we just want to introduce everybody to Joe. How are you, Joe?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. For listeners, in case you don't know, this is Joe Madry, who is one of the kind of a hugely influential and kind of important sort of writer about Millennium and kind of in relation to Millennium. He worked on, I believe, Lance Henriksen's biography, Not Bad for a Human. You also received thanks for the recent documentary, Millennium After Millennium. And you also contributed to the wonderful anthology, Back to Frank Black, which I'll probably actually be referencing quite a bit in this discussion. So thanks very much for coming on, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure entirely. And before we do, so this is your first appearance on the podcast. So what we're going to do is we're going to subject you to our own trick bag. I'll try not to cut you off when you're answering, but please turn to face me or the source of the sound when you're answering. So we have five questions that we typically ask sort of new recruits or new kind of guests on the podcast, just to get a sense of how you feel about Millennium, where your preferences are and kind of what your interests are in particular about the show. So the first question we ask, which is, when did you first discover Millennium?
I was a latecomer to Millennium. I didn't watch it when it originally aired at all. I followed X-Files somewhat. I was very interested in the myth-heavy episodes more than the standalones. But Millennium, I was aware of it. You know, what's ironic is that it would have been kind of the perfect show for me. I've always been a horror fan. I certainly knew Lance Henriksen's work. Would constantly rent films that he was in, even if it looked like a bad film, because I knew that Lance would be great. So this was right up my alley. But I think I had at that time when the show was on a little bit of snobbery in my approach to television, and so I really didn't follow anything religiously and really didn't give the show a chance until it was on DVD, when it first came out on DVD.
So that would have been what, around 2003-2004-ish?
I think it was 2003-2004, that sounds about right. I actually met Lance at a convention in 2004, so I'd seen it by then. But I don't know how I would have responded to it, having to wait a week in between episodes. I loved being able to binge watch it. You know, I think that was part of the charm. Although it also was kind of daunting, because the serial killer of a week thing, when it's you know, two or three serial killers a night, gets fairly intense.
It does. I mean, I've talked myself about this. I remember I kind of went episode by episode reviewing Millennium, and I found that like binge watching the first season of Millennium was quite a task, because I would have those weird nightmares, and it wouldn't be any particular episode would be too much for me. It wouldn't be any particular scene, but it was just the kind of constant sense of dread that watching two or three of those episodes back to back was incredibly emotionally draining. And I say that as somebody who loves the show.
Right. Well, tonally, it's so consistently dark. And there's not a lot of levity at all, which of course is one of the things they tried to change in the later seasons. But it can be tough to sit through that first season. But I was hooked. I was a horror fan, so it really kind of hit me right where I live.
And in terms of missing it on television but finding it on DVD, was it just recommendation, word of mouth? Was it message boards? What was it that kind of made you go, well, I skipped it while it was on weekly, but I think I'll pick up the DVD and give it a go now?
I don't remember. I wasn't friends with anybody that I can recall that recommended the show to me or that was talking about it. It may have been the fact that I was going to a convention that Lance was at, and I said, oh, I've never done this series, so let me watch this series before I go, you know, ask for the guy's autograph. That might have been what finally prompted me to sit down and watch it. I can't remember, but I do remember I went through it very fast, and loved it.
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, well, I mean, I would hope that you greatly enjoyed it, given your kind of contributions to it. It would be a very strange relationship if you didn't. And then the second question, actually, which I think will be kind of interesting in this context, particularly somebody who watched so much of the show so close together in first viewing, didn't wait a week between episodes and kind of didn't, you know, take a lot of space between them. What is your favorite episode?
I don't know that I had a favorite episode the first time through. I rewatched the whole series when I was working on Lance's biography. And I started thinking, there's a whole chapter in the biography about Millennium, and I had to figure out how to write about it as a series, and so I'm looking for through lines and you know, whatever continuity is there to approach it as a series as a whole. And I got really attached during that second go round with the whole series. I really loved second season, and to me, the reason I wanted to talk about Luminary was, to me, it's Luminary is sort of this high point of second season that's really all about the character of Frank Black and how he distinguishes himself from this whole, you know, fictional world around him and from the Millennium Group and from his family. And to me, that's the character that Lance plays is really the core of the show. And Luminary is just I don't think it was designed as such. The episode wasn't designed to fit into a myth arc, if you will, at all. I think it was designed as conceived and designed as a standalone episode. But to me, it really is this high point of season two that you know, you have a real build up to that point, which is all about Frank Black kind of going into the darkness after you know, actually killing somebody at the end of first season, and then the reckoning that he has to do with that. You know, it's the hero's journey, and we reach this kind of high point of the hero's journey, and then it actually, he has to kind of reintegrate himself into the world after Luminary. So it just, to me, feels, and especially because it's a three season show, you know, I don't think it falls in terms of the numbers of the episodes squarely in the middle of the series, but it feels like the middle of the entire series.
It's the middle of the second season, and therefore the middle of the middle season as well. And it does kind of become a point at which everything pivots. And I think you're entirely right about it being a hero's journey. But we're not going to preempt our kind of discussion of the episode, which we're going to talk about in a bit more depth later on. But just to jump to the third question, and I suspect you probably already answered this, but just in case you're going to throw us a curveball, what is your favorite season of Millennium?
Yeah, I have to say I'm a second season guy. And I think it is just because of the through lines. I love the mythical quality of it. I think that's the strongest in the second season.
Perfect. And then fourth question, who is your favorite character on the show? And again, it could be Frank Black. It could be a one-shot guest character. It can be anybody ranging on the show whatsoever. So if there was one character on the show that really kind of spoke to you and who you think about when you think about Millennium, who is it?
That's definitely got to be Frank. I mean, I think the idea of one man against a thousand points of darkness, you know, he's the reason that the show exists. That character is the reason that the show exists. And the thing that makes it stand out from, well, I guess from, you know, just being another horror movie, I suppose, yeah. You know, just the light of that character and the strength that he brings, that's opposed to all of the darkness, you know. That's and having watched the show and talked so much about it with Lance, it's hard for me at this point to not see the series somewhat through his eyes, or through that character's eyes, just because I've had so many conversations with him and he sees it in that very personal way. So having looked at it for the book and rewatched the entire series kind of from his perspective, it's sort of hard for me to go back to being more objective about it.
Absolutely. And there's so much of kind of Lance Henriksen in there as well, in terms of just like how much he brings to the character as well. And it's very hard to separate, as you point out, the show from him. You know, with the X-Files, you have the format of the two-hander. And I mean, structurally, Millennium is quite similar to any number of kind of other procedural shows. But it is, I would argue, I'd agree with you on this, that it's Frank Black who makes it different. Really is a fantastic character and performance. And then finally, the fifth question, and probably the toughest, actually. What's your favorite moment from the show? Like, if you had to pick one moment from the entire run of the series that kind of sums up your relationship with it, or that you would point to as kind of the highlight, or the moment that defines the show, what would it be for you? No pressure.
Yeah, wow, really? I don't know. Maybe because I'm somebody who spent the last, I don't know, 10 years. Has it been 10 years? It's been more than 10 years thinking about the show coming back as an image that really sticks in my head. You know, Frank and Jordan running down the hallway in silhouette at the end of season 3.
And goodbye to all this, is the pretty, final episode, isn't it?
That's pretty evocative, because of course it leaves you wondering where do they go from here, and how would he come back, and it just leaves you wondering about the larger implications of the whole story. I mean, you know, the fact that the series ended before the millennium happened, there's so much left unexplored. I guess I'd have to say that's probably the image that most sticks with me, or the scene that most sticks with me all these years later, just as a jumping off point for what could have been or what could be.
Because it is, I think you're right there. It's at once something that kind of sums up a lot of what the show is about, and kind of, but also so evocative and suggestive, because it's not just a literal goodbye to all that. There's something out there that's worth exploring or going to. You know, whatever happens, you know, in future appearances on the X-Files, that's an ending that suggests, you know, Frank and Jordan are out there adventuring in the world, you know?
Yeah, I don't count that X-Files episode. That's non-canon for me.
And I don't think there would be too many Millennium fans who disagree with you. All right, then. So let's move on to talking about Luminary, which is the episode that we're kind of here to discuss today. And before we kind of jump into actual discussions, what we do is we generally tend to check the IMDb and just sort of get a sense of how it's seen on there by fans who vote about it on the internet. And so 234 people have kind of rated Luminary on IMDb. And what we normally do, and this is a wonderful parlor game for guests, I've been on the other end of this and I can tell you it's great fun. Out of 10, what do you reckon IMDb has given Luminary? What do you reckon the score is? And to play entirely fair, the second season runs from a low of 6.8 for Sense and Anti-Sense up to a score of 8.9 for Somehow Satan Got Behind Me. So that's the kind of range we're operating in.
Wow. Satan gets the highest rating. That's interesting.
I was as surprised as you are on that one, actually.
I would guess that Luminary is pretty close to that. I suppose as I think about it, there's such a cult following for the Satan episode. I guess I can understand that. But I would like to think that Luminary is not too far below that, like maybe an 8.7.
I'm afraid it's an 8.1, actually, which is about even for the season. So to give it, like, we're not going to give out next week's score, but it's ahead of Goodbye Charlie at 7.6, but below, say, Midnight of the Century and Jose Chung, which are at 8.4 and 8.6 precisely. So it's an interesting one. It seems like it's an episode that people are reasonably fond of, but also not necessarily an episode that many of them would consider to be among the kind of high points of the season. And this is interesting, because I think this is a nice sort of springboard into talking about the episode yourself. How would you rate it out of 10? Is it a perfect 10 for you? Which is kind of the sense I got maybe when I asked about your favorite episode.
I don't know if there are any perfect 10s, and I think it's because on Millennium, there's always such a pull in every episode, I think, between the mentality of approaching stories as standalones and then approaching it as a series. I think that's something that the people who are making the show never quite found a balance with. And so, I mean, I would probably give it a 9. If I'm thinking in terms of sort of the quality of an episode and just the sort of the pure integrity of an episode as a standalone, I might actually rate the pilot higher because you don't watch that thinking about the context of the entire series and how it fits in. It almost functions as just a standalone film.
Well, it was screened in cinemas, if I recall correctly, as well. Like, it was an event. And I think Carter himself sort of singled it out at Austin, I think, in 2013. As like a standalone piece of work that he's very proud of. So I can absolutely see that, I think.
Yeah, and I know they did a screening out here. A lot of people talked about that when we were doing the interviews for the documentary, about going to see it. I forget what theater it screened at, maybe out here in at the theater in Westwood in L.A. But everybody kind of had the same reaction, which is, this is not a TV show. You can't put something like this on TV. It does play more like a movie, so it made an impression.
And I would actually, I'm gonna not hedge at all. I'm gonna say I would actually give Luminary a 10 out of 10. And I think you're onto something with regards to difficulty in separating it from the season around it. And I think then this is kind of worth talking about with regards to Luminary, because you kind of mentioned it when we talked about it earlier on in terms of its position in the season, because it is positioned roughly halfway. It's notable as being one of three episodes of the season written by Chip Johansson. He had written Sense and Anti-Sense earlier in the season, and he'd go on to write In Arcadia Ego towards the end of the season. And it's kind of odd, because with the second season, you get a real sense of it being kind of more, James Wong and Glenn Morgan's baby in terms of showrunners, in terms of stepping in after Carter had to step away to work on the fifth season, The X-Files, and to work on Fight the Future. And they're very much the kind of driving forces. And if you look at the writing credits on the season, they write a phenomenal amount of the second season. And as showrunners, one suspects they also did a very hefty amount of rewriting as well. But it's kind of interesting that this is an episode that like feels very much like a Chip Johansson episode. It feels very much kind of in touch with what he feels about the show and the earlier stuff he's written. I mean, whether you want to talk about things like, say, the subplot involving Catherine, which feels like what he did back in the first season with Blood Relatives, or the interest in astrology, in particular, say, Pluto and Neptune, which obviously kind of plays up kind of later in the third season when he takes over as showrunner and does stuff like Bardot the Doll and Saturn Dreaming of Mercury. But, I mean, it very much feels like a Johansson episode, but it also feels like an episode that is perfectly positioned in the second season, in Frank's kind of hero's journey. Do you think that if you took it out of that context, it would work as well? Do you think that there's a way in which it works on its own, or does it only make sense as part of kind of a larger object, as part of the second season, when you kind of step back and view, I think you described it as a hero's journey, which it absolutely is?
I mean, I think if it weren't placed in the middle of the season, didn't have that larger context, the obviously the stuff, the scenes at the beginning and the end with the Millennium group would not resonate. I think a lot of the stuff with Frank, with his family, and with Alex Glazer's family, and in Alaska, the journey he takes to Alaska, I think all that would work as a standalone. And I think that Chip Johansson, I think he conceived this. I'm pretty sure he has said in interviews that he conceived this as a standalone, that he was working on a pilot for a perspective series called Vanishing Point. And the basic idea for that was to follow different stories of people who were part of I guess what you would call like a dropout culture in a way. You know, he referenced the John Krakauer book Into the Wild as sort of the main inspiration, being about a real person, Chris McCandless, who's sort of was a young guy, maybe 20-ish, dropped all of his worldly possessions and went off to Alaska, and it's sort of trying to figure out what his life is without all of the influences of other people. Right, certainly the trappings of materialism, but just yeah, I mean, almost kind of an existentialist journey, and so I think that was how Chip was approaching it. I'm trying to remember what the other book was. There was another book called Blue Highways by William Least Heat Moon. And it was a guy who was an older guy. I mean, not older. He was, you know, middle-aged, but sort of lost his job or quit his job or something, and then got in his van and just drove around the country, taking the sort of old rural highways that nobody would use anymore because interstates, it was a quicker way for people to get from place to place, but he wanted to get from place to place slower and meet people along the way. And so just this idea of taking a journey, I think that's something that Lance, when he did this episode, could really relate to, because Lance had sort of a nomadic early life. I mean, he crossed the country several times just hitchhiking. And had some sort of close encounters with death, and certainly a lot of close encounters with poverty, and just trying to figure out where he belonged and what he was doing in life. So I think it was a really personal episode for Lance, and I think that that comes through, and I think that's why it's a strong episode, not just because of the writing, but because Lance is very much an individualist. His, you know, I think playing the part of Frank Black, I think his relationship with the Millennium group was always a little testy, at least in Lance's mind. you know, like I said, he's kind of a loner. I mean, he's a perfect person to cast in a role doing that hero's journey, because, you know, Lance is just sort of a cowboy.
Well, that's it. I think Carter described the role of kind of Frank Black as he envisioned him in the first season as a cowboy, as the man who comes to town. You can see that in episodes like, I think it's Covenant. I always get Covenant and Sacrament mixed up, but Covenant, the one where he literally comes into town to investigate a murder and kind of ends up, or a series of deaths, and ends up kind of exposing the secrets, or even like Broken World. There's a real sense of him as kind of a wandering dude. Gooder, kind of a end of 20th century Gary Cooper kind of cowboy figure, and I think Henriksen carries that really, really well.
He does. He has, you know, it's there in his voice. It's that you can see it in his face. It's there in the way he speaks, the way he pauses before he speaks and really considers what he's the opposite of me. I just you know, ramble, but you know, he's very measured in the way that he deals with the world, confronts the world, and addresses the world. Very, very serious about his interactions. Although, you know, I can imagine that if he were here right now, he would also kind of laugh and say, "Joe, you're making me sound very sort of stodgy,
very serious, you know, and stoic."
He does have a sense of humor, and that's maybe the part that people don't see as much. But you know, but it was hard. But he had a, you know, in this particular series, when it's a guy who's investigating. You know, murders and tragedies every single episode, constantly, you know, and there's not, I think bringing out the humorous side to him felt wrong, because he felt he had to treat it with a great deal of seriousness. And, you know, Luminary, in spite of there not being any murderers in it, you know, is just as serious as all the other episodes. I mean, it still is an episode that's asking big questions about life.
It is indeed. It's very sort of existential piece. And I think it's actually, and again, before we kind of move on, just talking about it in terms of like the second season as a whole. And one of the interesting discussions and kind of lines of criticism of the second season, I think that Lance himself has maybe advanced certain kind of strands of this, is the question of kind of the idea of transformation as happens, like with regards to Frank between the first and second season, and with, say, the Millennium Group between first and second season as well, where it goes from being in the first season a fairly obvious stand-in for the Academy Group, and in the second season becomes something a lot more ominous and vague. And again, you can argue that there are seeds, you know, planted in the first season, but they really come out here. And even, say, the characterization of Frank as well, where kind of his character maybe shifts a little bit. You see him, and it's kind of interesting that you mentioned sort of stoicism, because I think one of the things that I quite like about the second season version of Frank is that he feels a lot more human in a way. And you can point to its little things, like all of a sudden Bobby Darin is his favorite sort of performer, because obviously he's now written by, you know, James Wong and Glenn Morgan. But even things like, he does become a bit more kind of wry and a bit more sort of, you know, a bit funnier, a bit softer, a bit gentle, a bit more human. But I think that one of the big tensions that runs through the second season is that relationship between Frank and the group. And I think that it's kind of interesting you mention Lance being kind of an individualist and kind of fitting in that niche, because this is one of the things that I think Luminary does rather well. And I think it's something that maybe needed to be done in the second season at some point. And this is probably the perfect place to do it, which is to kind of explain how or why Frank is tied up in the Millennium Group at this point in the show. Because, you know, he's lost Catherine at this point. The Millennium Group has become incredibly ominous, incredibly sinister. It doesn't seem like a healthy environment. I mean, even at the start of this episode, you have them running the trick bag on him, which is very much not a friendly kind of induction. It's very much a kind of a hostile. And the way it's presented is almost like a cult. You get that wonderful shot across the eyes, the light across the eyes, which makes it seem like an interrogation they're conducting. And I mean, like, you've had earlier in the second season Jose Chung's, which is, you know, maybe perhaps offering a commentary on a contemporary cult in American society. I don't want to name them because they're very litigious. Mm-hmm. But it kind of, one of the things that I really like about Luminary that I think is very important is that it underscores why Frank is involved in the group, or at least it does for me watching it. It kind of explains and answers why Frank is still eager to join the group and why Frank is participating and why Frank sort of puts up with them. And I think that that's kind of an interesting aspect, because it brings up that stuff you mentioned about individualism and the desire to go off and to be alone, obviously heavily inspired, as you pointed out, by Into the Wild, which I think was released in 96, but was still in the New York Times bestseller list when this episode was broadcast. But I mean, you know, you have obviously other traditions. And again, this is where I ramble a bit, where I'm like, you know, like Northern Europe has the Vonderjag, which is the idea of kind of taking a year off between graduating college and going into work, where you wander the world, or kind of Aboriginal or Native American traditions where people wander the wild for a set period in order to find themselves while being lost from society. But the idea that you eventually come back, and I think Luminary underscores the idea that Frank is lost at this point in the second season, that he's kind of, he is wandering, and that he on some level wants something that he can grab onto, something he can hold onto.
Well, I think you're right that if I'm understanding you right, you're sort of pointing out that an important part of the character is the fact that he does go back and he does re-engage with the world. He doesn't disappear the way that Alex does. He goes back. I mean, obviously he has a family, so that's a pretty strong pull, you know, going back for his daughter. That's you know, one of the things that keeps him, or you know, if not the main thing that keeps him tethered to the world. But I think Frank and Lance both, as individuals, want to make a contribution. They want to help people, and you have to, you know, I mean, this spiritual journey, as a myth or whatever, is kind of all about getting excuse me, getting yourself right, getting your own head right, so that you can be a useful presence in the world. And I think that's Frank, and I think that's Lance. When we did a screening of the, well, not a screening, we did like a Q&A for the documentary when it was coming out a few months ago out here at the LA Comic Con. And I remember Lance came by and picked me up to go to that. And as I was walking out to the car, we were meeting out at the car, and we saw someone's, or he saw someone's wallet, that somebody had lost their wallet, and it was lying on the ground. And Lance, you know, was ready to put the whole thing. I mean, I think we might have even been kind of running late for this thing, and we really needed to get on the road and get downtown and get to this convention. But, you know, he picked it up and he wasn't going to go until we could kind of figure out whose wallet it was and how to get it back to them and all of this. And he just, because he saw it, he took ownership of that moment.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's just sort of a defining moment. I mean, it's a character moment. I've got another friend who's always kind of saying, if it's in front of you, it's yours. Doesn't matter if you don't want it to be there. It does, you know, it can be somebody that you hate, that you're just trying to avoid, or a situation you're trying to avoid. If it's in front of you, it's yours. Take responsibility for it. You know, that's Frank. I don't think he ever runs away. He's going after Alex. He's trying to help Alex. You know, he's on a mission, and in the process, it helps him get his head right. But then he comes back because that's really who he is trying to help other people. And so it's an episode that really drives that home. And the conflict with the Millennium Group is about, listen, are you guys helping people or not? You know, what's your agenda here? Frank's very clear about his agenda. He knows what his agenda is, but what's their agenda? You know, and so he comes back in, and in spite of the difficulties, it might be easy in some ways for him to just say, I don't know what you guys are about. You know, there's a lot of complications here. I just want to kind of go do my thing and help people and not be involved in all of your politics or whatever. You know, and I could see Lance to a certain extent, you know, maybe doing that. But Frank doesn't do that. And I think that's one of the things that sort of, you know, defines his characters. He's still trying to, he accepts that the Millennium Group is problematic. You know, he accepts that because that's what's in front of him. And in a way, he's maybe trying to help them as much as he and the Millennium Group collectively are trying to help other people. I don't know. I mean, he accepts that instead of running away from it, though. And so that's again, I think, another one of the strengths of the episode. And that's there in the writing. It's there in Lance's performance. you know, it's a standout episode.
This is kind of interesting because I've always had a kind of a slightly different reading. I think that's probably one of the strengths of the second season is that it, and you know, the show as a whole, is that it leaves it open for kind of slightly different readings and for a little bit of ambiguity and nuance there. I've always kind of seen Frank's relationship with the group in the second season as being very cult-like, as being very sort of like, he is, as you pointed out, he is lost to a certain degree. He, you know, the first season he had the Yellow House and that was kind of his magnetic north. Everything that he was doing was to make the world a safer place for Jordan, and also because he was a fundamentally decent person, and making the world a better place is part of the responsibility of being a decent person. And he had that sort of sense of direction in the first season that the second season kind of takes away from him. And it the hero's journey in the second season is the journey kind of back towards the house for him, or at least as far as he's concerned, is back towards trying to restore that family and to find what was lost. And I think for me, the relationship with the group in the second season has always been this kind of ambiguous, kind of vaguely cult-like organization where it's Frank is looking for an ordering principle, if that makes sense. And here you have it juxtaposed with Catherine turning to astrology. And like Catherine actually says to Peter later on in the episode, you know, I turn to astrology because I have no other frame of reference in my life for what's going on. And I've always seen Frank's relationship in the group, with the group in the second season as kind of an analogous to that. It's like he's lost what was always kind of like he deemed to be important and his center of gravity. And he's kind of just flying through the universe. And he's still got that sense of right and wrong. He's still fundamentally driven by, you know, a desire to do good. I mean, as you point out in this episode, he's the person who understands Alex. He's the person who goes after Alex. He's the person who doesn't give up on Alex. And that's a fundamentally decent thing to do. I don't think that it's at all like, say, self-destructive or suicidal. I think he needs to go and find Alex, yes, because it's the right thing to do, but also because if he can find Alex and he can save him in some way, that's, you know, a metaphorical expression of his own anxiety as well, because he can be found in the wilderness, he can be recovered. And you know, the episode juxtaposes the two. You have Alex's kind of narration feeding in from the shot of the body going through the water through to the sequence where, you know, Frank is taken into the group, and then cutting back to Frank's body, sorry, to Alex's body in the water, as if to kind of draw and parallel the two. You have Frank reading the journal, and you have the, you know, the voiceover of Alex reading the journal as you're watching Frank, which kind of suggests the two are kind of parallel. I think for me, what's always been interesting about the second season is the sense that while Frank is always like morally righteous and is always kind of like a true hero as much as it is possible to be a hero, there's always a sense for me that in the second season he's a little bit kind of, he's not that he's lost his way is a bit of an overstatement, but he's trying to find or to affirm his way. And I think that for me, that's always been the heart of the relationship with the Millennium Group there in the second season. But maybe that's not a reasonable reading.
No, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I think the Millennium Group definitely becomes a cult. I think that's kind of a hard shift from first season to second season, that in the first season it's the Academy group, and that's how the group was written in the first season. That's what the writers intended. And then you know, it's a different, you know, there's some constants between first and second seasons on the team of writers, but there's a lot of different writers who sort of reconceived the group. And then, and I think Lance really struggled with that in the role of Frank, trying to figure out what the group is supposed to be. I mean, I think that's something he struggled with as an actor, was wait, when and how did this shift happen? And so you see that in the character. The character is going through that too. I think you're right that there's a lot of self-doubt in that character. You see that the most in probably The Curse of Frank Black, which is another great episode. And now that I've, you know, at the beginning of this podcast said that Luminary is my favorite, I'm thinking about some of these other episodes and going, God, Curse of Frank Black is amazing. You know, and that's, you know, if Luminary's the high, even though they're, I think they're only, what, like two or three episodes apart in terms of when they aired, they, you know, Curse of Frank Black is kind of like the low point where he's egging the Yellow House and just wallowing. And then, you know, Luminary is kind of this high point where he gets over, you know, it's a very sort of mystical trajectory, you know, that you have to hit rock bottom before you can break through and transcend and all of that. You know, there's, you're right. There's a lot going on there. And I think the fact that it's so many different writers on the second season who are brilliant, but but kind of
at odds almost, perhaps.
Yeah, in a way, operating on their own, in terms of what they think the character is, what they think the Millennium Group is. I can't remember who it was when we were doing the documentary. Somebody said, it really wasn't a writer's room on this series the way that writer's rooms operate now on serialized shows, where everybody has to kind of agree on the continuity, and you work out all of the details. It seems like everybody, there were what I think Chris Carter would call tone meetings, maintaining the tone of the series. But I think a lot of the plot points were worked out pretty loosely, and you just kind of had to adhere to what had gone before. But I don't know how much of a big overarching plan there was going forward, which is maybe one of the weaknesses of the series. So I think you can read a lot of things, especially into second season, because it gets so, I don't know what the word is, intellectual, mystical. I mean, there's just the mythological. There's so many layers to season two, which is why I love it. But there's a lot of ambiguity as well as a result of all that.
And I think that's one of the core strengths of the second season, is that it leaves these gaps. And I think that you're entirely right. It's down to kind of like a contradiction between, the writers who are working on the show. And again, I am very fond of both Morgan and Wong and Johansson. And particularly, I think Johansson's sort of work on the end of the third season is somewhat underrated and underappreciated, particularly given the context in which he kind of took over a freight train that was already kind of heading down the tracks. And I think that they've been honest that, Johansson's been honest that he maybe didn't grok, as it were, with the vision that Morgan and Wong had. And I think that, despite the fact that maybe he didn't connect, the episode somehow does. The episode somehow fits absolutely perfectly where it belongs and where it needs to be. And again, I think that you're right that it kind of ties into The Curse of Frank Black, because I think that this is a key part of it. It's what you mentioned. It's the fact that Frank goes back at the end, which is very similar to The Curse of Frank Black, where what defines Frank is that even though he has these long, dark midnights of the soul, he goes back and he cleans the Yellow House after he exits. Or, he wanders off into the wilderness, but he comes back. And even, I think, Peter says, literally at the end, when they're loading Alex into the plane, it's like, oh, he'll come back. Is an understanding right there. And I think that's a core part of the character. And I think when I say Frank, Frank is ambiguous, I don't mean Frank is like a gritty anti-hero who might have lost his way. I mean, Frank experiences doubt in the way that normal people experience doubt, in the way that is, very, very relatable. And I think that Henriksen himself in Back to Frank Black talked about how this script in particular kind of jumped out at him because he had maybe gone through, I think he cites going through a divorce, which is very similar to the familial separation that Frank's going through here, as like an experience that made him want to go out into the wilderness and just get lost, and kind of having to pull yourself back to society after that. And I think that it is a very universal experience underneath it. And this is kind of interesting because I think that maybe that's why Luminary kind of works well, both as you pointed out, an episode in this overarching kind of structure of the second season, but also as an episode of television of itself, because I think that you don't need to, it helps obviously to have the context for the Millennium Groups at the beginning and scenes at the beginning and the end, and to understand where, Peter Watts fits into all this, and maybe what the relationship is between Frank and Catherine, although I think the episode makes that clear. But I think the broader underlying kind of feelings of the episode, which are that feeling of wanting to maybe wander off into the wilderness and, having to find your way back, or choosing to find your way back, and why choosing to find your way back is important, are things that I think people can understand emotionally, regardless of how connected they are to the particulars of the mythology of the show. And I kind of want to talk about that then, just in terms of kind of the episode as a standalone, because I think that this is one of the things Millennium doesn't always get the credit that it kind of deserves for doing, which is that this is a show, and again, it's like The X-Files. It's a very zeitgeisty show. I think it understood kind of culture or or kind of the mood or the atmosphere in a way that it doesn't always get credit for. And you kind of, you can see that obviously it's drawing on, as you mentioned, Into the Wild, the book about Christopher McCandless, who was the teenager who wandered off into the wilderness and became a folk hero of sorts. And it's kind of like you read accounts from Alaska where like authorities in Alaska still rue, you know, McCandless, and actually had to move the magic bus, the location where he tragically died, because it became a site of kind of, you know, of kind of patronage, of kind of people visiting, or pilgrimage, sorry, people coming to visit the site and to pay their respects, and tourists getting trapped and lost there. I think they actually moved the bus itself to somewhere where it would be safer for kind of tourists to go and visit. And it right. kind of, the episode in particular kind of taps into a sense of existential ennui. And again, this is something I think the second season as a whole does repeatedly. It taps into this sense of, as a culture and a society, being kind of lost and kind of feeling out of step and looking for something real. I think that when Alex is talking about why he went to Alaska, he mentions the family trip they took, and, you know, his father mentions we never got off the boat, or we barely got off the boat. But he talks about the feeling like it was being like he was trapped in an elaborate simulation of a world. And again, like that's an image that, you know, It's an evocative image, but it's an image that you see rippling through pop culture in the late 90s as well. You know, The Matrix would come out the following year. 13th Floor would come out the following year. You had The Truman Show that was going to come out. You had Carter working on Harsh Realm at around the same time as well. He'd be launching that after Millennium finished as well. And the sense of the world not being kind of real or not making sense and trying to understand it, is something that I kind of associate with late 90s culture, and I think is something that the second season, Millennium in particular, but I think Millennium as a whole, really understands, which is kind of amazing for a show that is nominally about the end of the world. It actually understands that, like, one of the anxieties was not the idea that the world was ending, but simply that we didn't have purpose in it, if that makes sense, if I'm not rambling too much.
Well, it's, you know, I think sort of generally you're talking about just this idea of a culture of fear, you know, and that fear is used to kind of control the masses. And so we're I mean, in the 90s, I think it's you know, serial killers was in the headlines, these kind of individual eruptions of darkness and anger and violence. And you know, why was it in the culture? I wrote, you know, this is kind of a cheeky thing to do, but I wrote the essay that I wrote for the Back to Frank Black book. I really delved into this because, as a horror fan and as a fan of gothic literature and all this stuff, I saw a lot of patterns there. And I'm not going to be able to articulate that very eloquently, because it's been a while since I did that research, and I don't remember all the particulars of how I pieced that together. But that was something that, everything you're talking about, is something I was really interested in, because it's the aspect of Millennium that is, you know, is essentially a horror movie. And why do people, why as a culture are we interested in horror movies? And not, you know, particular kinds of horror movies. I mean, when you talk about artificial realities or expanded realities or something like The Matrix, I mean, you know, then I start thinking about American cinematic horror or gothic in terms of kind of the Nightmare on Elm Street, Wes Craven sort of rubber reality thing. And I mean, God, there's so many roads to go down with this train of thought. I mean, when you know, I hate these days to even invoke this name, but when Trump was elected, I started reading a lot of Philip K. Dick, because alternate reality, I felt like we were living in science fiction. And so it's not something that went away with the 90s, really, in my mind. If anything, it's either come back around or intensified. And people, you know, people are afraid, and there are just certain parts of our culture that are feeding that fear, feeding off of that fear. And what is the response to that? How do you respond to that? I mean, I think this is why something like Millennium could come back, and why the Frank Black character could come back, because you need a response to that. And I think, I mean, if you look at like A Nightmare on Elm Street, what is the response at the end of A Nightmare on Elm Street to Freddy Krueger? You know, Nancy turns her back on him, says, I'm not going to feed the violence with more violence. I'm going to choose not to give this energy. And I think that's some of what Frank Black does, is to try to say, listen, this is not the better part of human nature. We need to engage our better, you know, energy, to use a super new agey term, you know, just to fight that, not with violence. You know, how do we overcome it? How do we overcome the darkness? How do we extract ourselves from the culture of fear? I mean, these are huge, huge issues, and they're all at the core of Millennium. And I mean, I want season 4, 5, 6, you know, because, you know, that's relevant. And I want to see where the writers who did Millennium would have taken that and how that would have developed. You know, like I said, that's why I've been involved with the, you know, with the Back to Frank Black campaign and contributed to their book and why we did the documentary and all of that. You know, it really is a show. Yes, you're absolutely right that it's very reflective of 90s culture and that pre-millennial angst. But I don't think that the things that were sort of, you know, that existential crisis.
Oh, it's been resolved. All of that. Yeah.
It hasn't been resolved. No, if anything, it's been amplified. So, yeah, that's the reason to go back to Frank Black.
Oh, yeah. No, and I mean, to be clear, I think that, like, and it's interesting that you mentioned serial killers, because, and again, I remember reading that article in the book and thinking it was great. And one of the things that always kind of struck me about serial killers, and I think about Millennium, and again, this is one of the things where I think the first and second seasons, people tend to treat them as like radically different animals, as almost as different television shows. And I don't think that's entirely fair, because I think that there's a clear through line or an extension that could be drawn, which I think that, you know, and again, not to reduce the question of why were the 90s obsessed with serial killers down to like a quick soundbite answer in 30 seconds. I suspect the answer is far more complex than what I'm about to offer. But I think why I always assumed the kind of 90s were interested in serial killers was the idea of random violence. Because like you had, you know, through the 60s in the Cold War, the idea of like the horror of organized violence, the horror of mutually assured destruction, of the enemy dropping the bomb, of communists. And I mean, it's interesting that, you know, like Nightmare on Elm Street in the 80s, the work of Carpenter with They Live and stuff like that. As the Cold War kind of thawed, you started getting, well, what about us? And you started getting a lot more of these kind of consumerist anxieties or kind of American cultural anxieties. And I think that like with the serial killers in Millennium, the fear of those serial killers is an expression of the fear of random violence, violence that doesn't have cause or motivation, doesn't have purpose. It just happens. Anybody can be a victim of a serial killer because, you know, they're just random, you know, arbitrary acts of violence that are, you know, that happen in a way that doesn't make any sense. And, you know, the show has this constant back and forth with Frank's gift where it's like, what is the nature of Frank's gift? Is it supernatural? Is he just highly empathic? Or is it just, are we watching these sort of Sherlock Holmes type deductions that allow him to see inside the mind of evil that we can't? And I think that what the second season does to build on that is it takes that same basic fear. And it's the fear of the unknown or of a chaotic universe or a universe without an ordering kind of moral principle. And then kind of extrapolates it outwards because, like, I really loved the first season, and I know the first season gave us episodes like, say, Walkabout, which kind of broke the format of the show, even like Broken World, which I would argue also kind of broke the format of the show a little bit, or Covenant, which broke the format a little bit in the second half. You would never have gotten an episode like Luminary in the first season because it just would have been too far off base. But somehow the show has reached a point where building from that fear of like a random chaotic universe in the first season to kind of like extrapolating that out to something more universal and existential, because I think everybody has asked, what am I doing here? What's my purpose? What's the point of this? You know, am I lost? Do I know where I'm going? And kind of finding a way to build an episode of Millennium about that is one of the things that I absolutely adore about the show. And I think that it fits perfectly. So I think that Luminary kind of like feels like an extension of kind of the themes Millennium's been grappling with since the pilot, but in a way that is more abstract and kind of broader, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I'm not sure where to run with that. I mean, it makes, you know, I'm starting now to think about third season, which is getting ahead of where you probably want to go in this podcast, or at least in this episode. You know, I think it's got me thinking about Frank as a character and where he ends up. I mean, some of what you were saying earlier about him being very, very kind of conflicting and having a lot of self-doubt. I think that really, in a way, for me as a viewer, is more apparent in season three. He seems really frayed.
Yeah.
You know, that his nerves are really frayed, and his focus is not there in the same way in season three. You know, he gets more scattered, which I guess was appropriate as you're approaching the millennium as this kind of, you know, within
ticking
the fictional...
clock almost kind of is getting closer. Doomsday is approaching, you know?
Yeah. So it becomes a more complicated story as you get into it. I mean, like I said, the Luminary is this real high point, this real show of strength. But he has to go back into the world, and that does not, having accrued that strength and had the experience that he's had in Luminary, does not solve the world's problems. He still has to go out, and the world is still a you know, dark and messed up place, and it still wears him down. And you know, I think where the show would have gone, or where I would have liked to have seen it gone, is for the people around Frank. You know, whether it's you know, people he's working with, or whether it's his daughter in later years or whatever, you know, that they absorb kind of the essence of who he is, and they go out into the world and are taking responsibility for whatever's right in front of them. And that you see that kind of ripple effect. I mean, that you know, and that's what I mean, as a catchphrase, you know, this is who we are. I mean, that's the real strength of Millennium as a series, isn't it? You know, this is who we could be. You know, we can take, you know, some of the ways that Frank tries to respond to the darkness in the world, and we can take that and learn from it and apply it. And so as Frank gets worn down, which happens because, you know, this is life and we're all going to die, and that's where we're all headed. You know, we're not going to win this fight, really, any of us. But the fight continues, you know, and we pass along what we've learned. And, you know, that's where I like to think of the show going, you know, even if it wasn't made, that's where I like to think that these characters end up.
And that's kind of interesting in the context of kind of Luminary, because I actually think that you're right about Luminary being a very hopeful piece and a surprisingly optimistic piece. Because, like, throughout the second season, and again, this is one of the things where I really like the thematic unity of the second season, where even though it's being written by a variety of different writers, it has, and I think I suspect that's down to what you mentioned, the Chris Carter tone meetings or the Morgan and Wong tone meetings, where it's like, this is what the season is about in kind of big capital letters. But the show in the second season keeps coming back to the idea of the apocalypse as a kind of a very personal experience, as something inherently subjective. It's something that kind of changes sizes. The world doesn't end, you know, when Earth gets obliterated by a meteor. Your world ends when, for example, Frank loses his family, or when, for example, you know, the tribe in A Single Blade of Grass, you know, gets separated or kind of disappear. It's that sort of world ending. And I mean, even here you have the astrologer telling Catherine that, you know, this time the great conflict is all your conflict, the two of you. So, like, this idea of kind of the big immortal battle, the epic battle for the fate of the world, all comes down to a relationship between two people. Or Frank's idea of family. But one of the things that I really like about Luminary is that despite the fact the second season is all about multiple apocalypses, kind of the end of the world, and again, I know many of our listeners are listening along for the first time, so I'm not going to, you know, mention any specific instance, but anybody who has seen the second season as a whole knows that, you know, it's building towards an apocalypse that is both epic and entirely personal to Frank as well. But you have in Luminary this idea, and it's a very clever one, it's a very moving one, it's a very compassionate one, it's a very warm and humanist one, which I think ties into kind of what you were saying, Joe, there about, you know, this being a relatively optimistic or upbeat piece, you know, by comparison to some of the tone of Millennium, where this is an episode that kind of ties the idea of death and rebirth. And you have it most obviously with Alex, who goes up into the wilderness, you know, a body is found that's announced to be him, but Frank goes up and saves him, but he comes back to civilization and he just disappears, almost like Jesus Christ. He just sort of, his body disappears and he wanders off taking a new name for himself as well. But you have obviously even like the wonder, and again, one of those wonderful little touches, the book that, you know, Catherine's reading, and she's imagining Frank in this sort of biblical image of kind of a man slaying a dragon, a man who kills monsters. But it's actually Jordan who points out that no, what the actual change of epoch is Frank going up the mountain, staring at the stars and receiving wisdom and being born again. And I kind of really like the way that Luminary finds a way that at once fits with this apocalyptic idea that runs the season, but finds a way to put a hopeful spin on it. So it's the end of the world, but something new will be born of it. Or, you know, it might be the end of Frank's world, but there's a possibility of recovering something or having a new beginning or having a new start. And I think that's a kind of a very elegant way of doing something that fits with the second season while still like not being as perhaps intensely tonally down as we described the first season as being at points when it's kind of serial killer after serial killer.
Yeah, well, it's you know, to an extent, the episode and the series are both sort of variations on the Orpheus myth, you know, that you the descent into the underworld to gain knowledge, and then you come back, and what are you going to do with that knowledge?
Yeah, and perhaps in a very literal way as you get towards the end of the season as well, and kind of, again, sorry, I feel like we're tripping over each other. I'm kind of like not spoiling what's coming up.
We're covering the same ground, I think, yeah.
Yeah, I imagine we both know what we're talking about, and many of our listeners know what we're talking about as well. And again, I do kind of, and even within this, there's a sense of kind of the idea of kind of cyclical patterns, and that even like the end of the world is something, the irony of the end of the world being something that happens continuously, where, you know, Frank is sitting in the auditorium at the planetarium, leaning over to Jordan saying, you know, I think they said the exact same thing when I was in second grade. Or the idea of Pluto and Neptune passing one another, which is something that happens every 500 years and causes a great deal of trouble, you know, but, you know, every time it's the end of the world, or every time it's a new beginning. And I kind of like that cyclical aspect there. I think there's something very, very clever in that. But I think just in terms of Luminary, is there anything else we haven't talked about? Anything that you want to kind of discuss? Anything that, you know, our kind of discussion so far hasn't touched upon, but you think is important to the episode?
I don't know if it's important. There's one sort of anecdote that popped into my mind as I was, you know, it's very typical of me to have invoked Freddy Krueger in a conversation that has nothing to do with Freddy Krueger, but it reminded me that Brian James is in this episode, yes, as the sheriff in Alaska. And I remember Lance saying that, well, one of the great things, one of the reasons he loved this episode so much was working with Brian James, because they got along really well. And I think they were, they probably would have enjoyed being able to have some more kind of humorous exchanges in this episode, because I think they had sort of similarly dark senses of humor. And they actually did a rubber reality horror movie together. This is a horrible note to end on. I shouldn't end on it. Like, Lance would give me hell for ending on this. But they did The Horror Show, which was also, I think it was released as The Horror Show in the U.S. and maybe House 3 in the U.K.
That sounds vaguely familiar. House 3
but
does.
Yeah, it, you know, it's, I think it's the only, so it's, you know, Lance as a cop chasing Brian James is a supernatural serial killer who can sort of turn into anything he wants and haunt Lance's character's dreams the way that, you know, a Freddy Krueger would. And I think it's the only movie where Lance attacks a talking turkey. So
I love that you have to qualify it with, I think, you know, there's a possibility. We don't want to be too tie ourselves down too hard to that.
This is a guy who was in, you know, three different Sasquatch movies. So, you know, don't put anything out of reach.
That's fair as well. And it is like Brian James is fantastic. And he passed away, was it last year, I believe, as well?
Yeah, 2 years ago.
And yeah, so hugely, hugely influential actor. And I'm a big fan of him. Obviously, his stuff in Blade Runner would be the role that I tend to think of. Which is, again, another talking turtle reference, possibly, as well.
We want to end on a note of levity, because you've got some lighter episodes of Millennium coming up. So it's a nice segue.
It is indeed. Well, I mean, to be fair, I do, you know, in terms of levity, then let's just pause and acknowledge the sequence in which Peter Watts opens the door and his daughters and wife have all drawn mustaches on themselves, which is one of my favorite sight gags in the entire history of Millennium. Whose idea was this, I think, is what you hear before he opens the door, which is delightful. It's one of those wonderfully mundane sequences, which the second season has quite a lot of. It kind of gives a sense of the characters, I think, as less archetypes and more people. And that's not to denigrate the first season in any way, shape or form. I really love it. But it does feel more like actual, the characters feel more like actual people, I think, in the second season, at least to me.
Yeah, it humanizes them. Right.
And also, don't you love that little mustache, to quote from another episode in the season. All right, then. So I think that about wraps it up, Joe. But if people are kind of looking for more of you, if there's something you want to plug or something that you want to recommend, or if people just kind of, you know, want a bit more Joe in their lives, where can they find you? What are you up to?
I've got a lot of things going on. I've got a new book coming out soon on the film Brainstorm with Christopher Walken, a standalone study of that film and various incarnations that it went through. It was about a 10-year development process from the original idea until the film got released, and it changed profoundly many times along the way. So that was a really fascinating study, and that book's coming as part of the Constellation series, and the book title is just Brainstorm. That should be out soon.
And I assume we can order that from Barnes & Noble, Amazon, wherever books are available.
All the obvious places should have it. I just did a documentary, an independent documentary on mixtapes, kind of as a cultural phenomenon, because I'm of the generation that grew up making mixtapes for girls that I had a crush on but couldn't talk to. And so we did kind of a fun documentary on that, just interviewing a lot of different people. I guess Henry Rollins has sort of become the headliner by default. Entertainment Weekly just posted the trailer for that documentary online two days ago. So it was just announced, and they clearly were fans of Henry Rollins, so they sort of latched onto the fact that he's there talking about mixtapes with great enthusiasm. So that's going to be out in the world soon. It's called Analog Love, and there's more coming, but it will get long-winded if I keep going. So
perfect. And do you have a website or anything where people can keep track, or if they want to sort of keep up to date on these things, actually?
Sure. Well, I have a blog, which is woefully out of date. I don't post on it as much as I should, but maybe I'll get back to it. It's Madrey, madrey.blogspot.com. And I've got, you know, I don't know, 10 or 15 years worth of ramblings about any number of different things, including Millennium, on there. So if anybody wants to lose some time digging through the archives, that's there.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Joe. This has actually been a real pleasure. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So anyway, join us next week when we'll be talking about the next episode in the show, which is, I believe, The Mikado, which is going to be a fun discussion. But until then, remember, this is who we are.
Previously on the We Made This Network. Pick up a podcast.
One thing they don't teach you, or there's no, like, one thing you're not prepared for when you start podcasting is the overwhelming imposter syndrome you have. Sometimes, you know, you're like, dude, especially in this case, because there was no other Outer Limits podcast. And so, like, I'm like, dude, if I have to hit the ground running, like, if it sucks, I mean, if you're like the 10th Outer Limits podcast and you suck, you know, whatever. But if like you're the only one, so many people have in their mind like what they want to hear.
Without a Mouse.
How was your Disney trip anyway?
Yeah, it was great. I've really enjoyed it. I got my photo taken with an Elvis impersonator at the front gate. Outside of Disney World.
And I can't believe you managed to kick Mickey, Goofy and Donald Duck in the balls.
Yeah, yeah.
All three.
Went for the hat trick.
Yeah, the holy trinity.
Apparently I'm the first person who's actually successfully done that in the whole of the world.
Yeah.
So they'll be writing books about me.
They will do.
I also was really glad that I only got food poisoning three times out there this time.
A new record for Disney.
Yeah, and a new record for me as well.
Please don't sue us, Disney. I'm sure everything is fine. Or if you have got food poisoning, they'll make you leave the park first before declaring it's food poisoning.
Pick a disc.
If we look at Marilyn and then we look at Too Late to Die Young, we start to realize that Dan Byrne has kind of a cultural fascination with some of the figures of his parents' generation, because he's talking about Elvis and James Dean and Marilyn Monroe and couple of the other songs have references to, like, Muhammad Ali and Pete Rose. Pete Rose and Roberto Clemente are in this song, Marlon Brando. So he does have this fascination that I think some people criticize him for. I think he's been like, hey, if this is supposed to be like Gen X Bob Dylan, then why is he fascinated with all the same figures that the baby boomers were fascinated with?
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.